From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, Estelle Friedman challenges our preconceptions of how and why sexual relationships have changed over the past 350 years. Friedman is the co-author of Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. Also today, we examine how professional wrestling went from a television oddity to a $300 million a year industry. I speak with journalist Irvin Muchnick. He's investigated what goes on inside and outside the ring. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the Kinks, one of the few bands from the British invasion that's still in action. And book critic John Leonard reviews Women in a River Landscape by the late German author Heinrich Boll. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. We'd probably all agree that the place of sexuality in American life has changed over the past 350 years. Estelle Friedman is a historian who wanted to know how those sexual changes correlate to cultural and political change in American history. Although today we have Dr. Ruth, Playboy, and clues to our sexuality almost everywhere we look, in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, the subject was much more private. To learn about the sexuality of those earlier times, Friedman went to court records on sexual crimes, diaries, letters, and reform tracts written by moralists who tried to describe sexual habits. Estelle Friedman is the co-author, with John D'Amelio, of the new book Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. She's an associate professor of history at Stanford University. I spoke with her from station KQED in San Francisco, and I asked her why she was interested in sexual history.
Well, I think there are two answers to that, and they both are somewhat personally historic. That is, I was becoming a professional historian in the early 1970s at a time when I think American youth, American society in general, was beginning to develop a new sexual politics, as the feminist movement called it, and all around me were questions of abortion, women's liberation, gay liberation, questions that I think made it into the national political agenda in the 70s and 80s, that for a young student of history raised questions about how did we get here? Mm-hmm. Why is this so important to us now? And more historically, in terms of the discipline and the profession, I was training at a time when the new social history, as it was called, became dominant in the field of historical studies, shifting our attention from political, public events such as war, diplomacy, the presidency, to personal life, to family life, the history of women, health, childhood. And I suppose that once you start studying the private side of history, ultimately you're going to get to the most private of all, which in our society has sometimes been sexuality.
Do you think that you learn something different about sexuality looking at historically than,
oh, yes,
than you would if you were looking at it, say, morally?
Oh, definitely. Or psychologically,
exactly,
or sociologically,
yeah,
although
mm-hmm,
they're related.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that bringing historical perspective, it rests on an idea that sexuality is historically and socially constructed, that it is not God-given, and that gets us away from the moralism a little bit. It is not static. It is not something just essential and intrinsic to each individual or something that we're all born with, but that historical factors shape the possibilities for sexuality in any era. And that opens up a question of change over time. How have the meanings and practices and ideas about sexuality changed over time? And that's very different. The moralist approach is somewhat more static, more judgmental. And I think that in working on the history of sexuality, you really have to let go of judgment and let go of contemporary notions of even what sex is, to look back and say, what did sexuality mean in the past? How did it differ? How did the meaning change over time? And then the question is, why?
Mm-hmm.
What economic, what demographic, what political factors reshaped the meaning of sexuality over the course of American history? And that's really what the book Intimate Matters is about, how that reshaping took place.
Well, before we get into some of the historic details of your study, I'm going to ask you a couple of big picture type questions.
Sure.
What are some of the preconceptions that you think your study challenges, the preconceptions that we might have about sexuality and how it's changed?
Well, I think that the key preconception that we try to challenge is that somehow the story of the history of sexuality is a triumphant one, moving from repression to liberation. that we go from these puritanical or Puritans or repressed Victorians to the liberated moderns. And we clearly challenge that notion at the outset and suggest that historians have known for a long time none of those stereotypes hold. And we actually want to change the question away from focusing on repression and liberation and suggest that those are not the interesting questions. That's really a false notion of historical change in terms of sex. If anything, the question we ask is, why has sex become so important in the modern period, not has it become better or freer? I think that's the main challenge that we undertook in trying to break away from past approaches.
Well, you're saying you're trying to look at why has sex become so important? Is that the way you put it?
Yes. In other words, the story is not so much has sex gotten better, more liberated, more free in some progressive way, but rather why have we become so obsessed about whether sex is good or not? Mm-hmm. Why has it become a key feature of individual identity and a major battleground in national politics, really? This was not necessarily the case 200 years ago, even 150 years ago. And gradually, I think over the last century, sex has become critical as a component of personal identity and increasingly a part of a national political conflict that we've seen particularly in the last generation.
That takes us back to a question you asked a couple of minutes ago, which is your investigation into what sex is and what does it mean to the people who are engaged in it. So let's go back a couple of hundred years. Your study really starts during the time of the colonies in America, at a time when you say sex was seen as, you know, pretty much just a reproductive function within a marital setting.
Right, which is not to say it wasn't pleasurable. In fact, there was not a conflict between those qualities of sort of the duty to procreate and individual pleasure. There was even a scientific, if you will, notion that one had to have pleasure, both man and woman, in order to conceive. So you have a nice congruence of pleasure and duty. And the primary meaning, as you say, of sexuality in that early period in the 17th, 18th century was familial reproduction. Sex might occur during courtship, but you'd better get married if you get pregnant. And indeed, the sort of small homogeneous communities of that period could usually enforce marriage in the case of pregnancy.
Would it be fair to look at the past? And I know you said that you don't really like to see sexual history in terms of liberation versus mm-hmm. repression. Yet, I think that your study really shows that there are so many predecessors in those battles, in mm-hmm. the current battle between repression and liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Can we look back at some of those predecessors?
Oh, yes, and we do. And I think that I would have to admit we're very delighted to find some of the stories of sexual radicals in the 19th century, for example. But again, to try to move it into a different way of looking at things, you can say, why did a free love movement appear in the 19th century? Why did the battles between the forces for free love, these kind of marginal radicals who argued not for promiscuity by any means, but that love should be free of the control of the state or of the church, that sex should only occur in loving relationships, not necessarily those sanctioned by marriage. Why did this appear in the 19th century, and why did it evoke such strong condemnation and criticism at the time, including very strong repressive measures by the likes of anti-obscenity reformer Anthony Comstock, who mm-hmm. really brought the wrath of the government down and imprisoned these free lovers in the late 19th century. Rather than looking at them just as heroes and heroines who mm-hmm. Called for a new idea of sexuality, we tend to ask, how did those ideas about free love reflect larger changes taking place in which sex had moved from this reproductive meaning to a more spiritualized meaning, a sense of intimacy, a way of bringing couples together? And in that case, the free lovers become essentially the logical extension of the dominant new meaning of sexuality. Yes, they were the extreme, but they also reflected tendencies towards a romanticized, spiritualized sex that was, in a sense, infiltrating American middle-class family values about sex, not just reproduction, but intimacy, love, passion, and holding the marriage together. So that they're not just radicals. They really are coming out of a movement throughout the society. Why do they have such a strong effect, such a strong reaction against them? Well, because they were the extreme, because they were the logical extreme of a movement that frightened many people who wanted to go back to a reproductive system. And thus you get the severe repression, I think.
My guest is Estelle Friedman, and she's the co-author of the new book, Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. Let's talk about some of the regulations that there have been over time of sexuality. Recently we've seen some court cases in which sodomy laws that have been on the books that haven't really been used for years, really archaic laws, have been used again.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back a couple hundred years again. When the sex laws were actually on the books, and when the legislature was one of the main characters in the control of sexuality, were these laws really enforced?
Yes and no. That is, you have sodomy laws, for example, as early as the 17th and 18th century, and indeed they were occasionally enforced, although not always to the full extent. It was a capital offense in many of the colonies, and there are occasions of execution for sodomy in the 17th and 18th century. There are also cases where, for example, a wealthy man generally respected in the community is not going to be executed, but fined or temporarily banished and then forgiven. So that there was always an uneven enforcement of some of these laws. And in the 19th century, the sodomy laws, as well as many other laws about morality, about sexuality, declined in terms of enforcement. State legislatures were more interested in economic growth and in regulating the economy ultimately. And this concern about the state and morality, I think, reappears in the 20th century at a time when sexual values had changed so greatly that there's a new crackdown on the boundaries, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about this in the 20th century not so much in terms of a sexual revolution, but as something we call sexual liberalism that dominates in the first half or more of the 20th century, when the meaning of sexuality has really separated from reproduction to the extent that individual happiness is defined as sexual pleasure, presumably in marriage or on the way to marriage. But the boundaries around that become tightened so that acts such as sodomy or homosexuality as a practice are more threatening as sort of the acts within marriage and youth sexuality are loosened up and there's more acceptance of them. And so within the system, which looks to some like a sexual revolution, there are tightening of enforcement around the boundaries, and homosexuality is a good example. Not just the sodomy laws, but for example, in the post-World War II period, the government began firing homosexuals from the civil service, from the military, real sort of witch hunts to enforce this boundary at the very time that you're getting a rise in sexually explicit materials in magazines and in movies. And you can sort of see this opening up to certain sexual ideas and practices while you maintain the boundaries by enforcing in other areas.
Let's get back to regulation for a second.
Yeah.
Your book is in part a history of who has tried to regulate sex.
That's true, yeah.
There's the church, there's the legislature, but then doctors enter the act, and there's a period when women themselves are considered to be the main regulators of sexuality. Can we talk briefly, first, about doctors? How did they, and in what way, were they expected to become, or did they become, regulators of sexuality?
I don't think they were expected to, but I think that with the emergence of a strong medical profession in the late 19th century, one of the ways that doctors upped their status, as it were able to get more public authority was through claiming authority over sexuality. In an earlier period, it had been the clergy who moralized about sexuality. Then there was a period in which there was really almost a vacuum of church and state interest in which women had been more interested in and powerful in regulating sexuality in the community level. But around the 1850s, 60s, when the American Medical Association had recently formed and began to lobby state legislatures, they really used issues such as abortion mm-hmm. as ways of claiming authority for doctors. As we point out, and as historians have known for some time, The criminalization of abortion in the late 19th century was led by the AMA, by the medical profession, not by religious leaders, not by clergy, not by women, but by doctors who really were trying to medicalize the problem. Previously, a woman could decide if a fetus had, quote, quickened or not. And if it hadn't, if it was before she claimed there was life, the abortion was not necessarily illegal or immoral. And it was really doctors who led the campaign to move control over abortion from the woman to the medical expert. So there's an example, I think most historians would agree, of doctors who had a very low status in the early 19th century, who didn't really know how to cure disease until germ theory in the late 19th century. At the same time that they're trying to upgrade their reputations as healers, they move out to become public authorities over issues that they claim as public health issues. And it's really, I think, in the late 19th and early 20th century that the medical profession reaches this heyday in terms of sexual regulation. And in the early to mid-20th century, the psychiatric profession joins in that process.
Let me ask you briefly about women as regulators. When was it expected that women would be the regulators of sexuality, and what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, you could say that both men and women had an important role in the community regulation of morality in traditional small colonial towns. In the 19th century, with the movement of men largely into the public sphere with industrialization and commerce, women in the home become very important as mothers, teaching their children sexual morality, teaching girls to be chaste and boys to contain their lusts. And they also, by the 1820s and 1830s, are organizing mothers' committees and moral reform organizations to oppose prostitution, to oppose male seduction. And they keep those organizations going in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, lead a social purity movement for a single standard of morality in the late 19th century. And then I think their power begins to dissipate somewhat in the 20th century, of sort of organized middle-class white womanhood.
Okay, well, I want to talk with you about birth control and about other changes in sexuality, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Estelle Friedman. She's the co-author of the new book, Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about a history of sexuality in America with my guest, Estelle Friedman, co-author of the book Intimate Matters. You know, in a way, I guess before there was reliable birth control, the only way a woman had to really control reproduction was to control her husband, to control
yes.
her sexual desires.
Yes, and there was actually a term for that method called voluntary motherhood, or a woman's right to say no to her husband.
Mm-hmm. Now, once there is birth control. Is that the turning point to you about when our definitions of sex start to change, when the role of sex in people's personal lives starts to change, when it starts to get cut off, when it's not completely associated with reproduction, when people start doing it more with a sense of personal expression, personal fulfillment? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's some truth to that, but I might turn the causality around a little bit and suggest that we get birth control mm-hmm. because sexuality and reproduction are being separated. And what I mean by that
is
that the family was beginning to reduce its size with the coming of cities, commerce, industrialization by the early 19th century. And couples begin looking for ways to do that, whether they do it by continence or abstinence or early forms of contraception. It's really in the early 20th century that you get a birth control movement led by Margaret Sanger, and later new technologies. So that I think, in a sense, you had people in search of birth control before you had the public acceptance of it. And yes, the change in sexuality is very related to the separation of it from reproduction, and birth control enhances that. But as I say, it's not the cause, it is an effect of these larger changes in the desired family size and then the meaning of sex within marriage when you're no longer having as many children as possible, say in an agricultural society.
But birth control is one of the conditions that did contribute to
a more open sexuality.
What were some of the other, I think, if
you look at both the entry of women into the paid labor force and contraception together, it goes a long way towards explaining why an old familial reproductive sexual system is never really possible again with contraceptive technology and women's work.
So you think that
sexuality moves away from its reproductive moorings. And the other element that one has to bring in here and that we emphasize in the book is that sexuality is being drawn outside of the home into the public sphere of commerce increasingly. And I think that's the other part of this formula of birth control, women's work, and the commercialization of sexuality.
And by commercialization, you mean sex in advertising, sex in TV, sex in the movies, sex in lyrics of songs, that sex is just much more public.
Very public, and also that it's tied to products. Both it's used to sell all kinds of products in a consumer-oriented society in the 20th century, and it becomes a commodity itself. Originally an illegitimate one, prostitution, but increasingly a sexual service industry or a sexual service sector of the economy develops from nightclubs and cabarets to Playboy clubs to male strippers to pornography. Sex is a big industry in America today.
So with your view of history, you think that there's really no turning back to the days when sexual relations were seen as procreative, purely procreative, and an act only to be had within marital relationship. You think because of women's changing role in society, because of contraception, because of the commercialization of sex, that there's no turning back.
Yes, I think that's a fairly accurate description of our conclusions, that we can never go back to what we had before, which is not a prediction of what will come in the future. It's very hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
But that, yeah, those three elements, particularly commercialization, birth control, and women's work outside of the home, have changed the meaning of sexuality irrevocably.
Now, in some ways, I think the AIDS epidemic is being used as a way to regain social control over sex by those forces in society who would like to regulate sex.
Yeah, I think there has been such an effort. You're right. I don't know that it can be successful because of those underlying historic changes we've just discussed, and because there's another element to the response to AIDS, which is to try to, in the face of such an enormous health crisis, open discussion of sexuality to a greater extent than in the past, so that the remaining taboos, the remaining discomforts about talking about sex in public may have to fall in a way that would undermine that effort to return to an earlier kind of moralism. So there's counter tendencies going on in response to AIDS, I think.
There are so many more gays and lesbians who are out now than I think we've ever experienced before. How do you think the gay liberation movement has affected the way the heterosexual sexual climate?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, do you think that there are things that heterosexuals have learned about sexuality, about male and female sexuality, through witnessing the gay liberation movement?
That's a very interesting question, and I don't know exactly how to answer it. I would say that certainly in the 1970s, a sort of gay male ethic of sex as pleasure and sort of taking the commercialization of sex in some ways to an extreme may have begun to filter out of just the gay community to perhaps it was just coincident with the sort of swinging singles heterosexual scene. So I don't know if it's so much influenced or if they're both part of the same pattern. And today in the 80s, I guess one could argue that the response to AIDS that the gay community has pioneered in some ways in this other trend that I was just mentioning about an openness about sex and safe sex and sexual health out of necessity that I think is coming more slowly to the heterosexual population, but nonetheless I think is becoming more important. I don't really have a good answer to that. It's almost a contemporary sociological question that I haven't thought about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that it reminds me, though, of some other kind of patterning that I'd like to go back to that's not quite as clear in the present, but in general, and that is the way that racial minorities have, in some periods, the early part of the 20th century, for example, been seen by the dominant white middle class as somehow sexual pioneers. And I'm thinking of the change in sexual morality, say, in the teens and the 20s, and the way that white youth began to emulate, say, the dancing and the sexual openness of some immigrant and black migrant youth cultures. And I don't know if you could draw a parallel between that period and what's happened, say, in the 70s and 80s in terms of the gay and lesbian sexual culture being something that other groups might emulate. But that's the kind of historical question I might want to think about, whether there's some parallels there. Certainly, I think the politicization of sex by feminism and gay liberation has been a model for both mainstream American society and certainly for the right, mm-hmm. which politicized in many ways in response to a feminist and gay left politicization of sex, a call for an extension of sexual liberalism to women and to homosexuals. And then you get, in response to that, this call to move back to a reproductive familial system from the new right and the moral majority.
Is studying sexuality in a historical context accepted in academia?
Increasingly so. When we started graduate school in the early 70s, I think each of us would have laughed at the notion of doing a history of sexuality. And by the time we had finished our training in the mid to late 1970s, we had begun to accept it, even if the old guard had not. By now, the late 1980s, we've been able to write a book based on really 10 or 15 years of research that has increasingly become respected. And at least thus far, the work that we've done seems to be considered quite legitimate.
Now that you've completed your history of sexuality in America, what are the next questions that you think sexual history should investigate?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're really looking forward to seeing how people respond. We tried to do an overview and a synthesis that would open up new questions. And I can say personally what I would like to do, and that is to look more closely at the history of sexual violence and particularly of rape. It was one of the questions that most intrigued me in working on this book. It was a key means of maintaining racial dominance in the 19th and 20th century, and it is one that is very central to a feminist analysis, has made feminist theory, has made rape a really central issue in the modern period. And I'd like to go back historically and see how the law, medicine, media have changed in their treatment of rape throughout our history. That's the next big question that I'd like to work on.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your current research. My guest has been Estelle Friedman. She's the co-author of the new book, Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America. It's published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Bob Hoskins. He's starring in the new Walt Disney Steven Spielberg production, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And he plays opposite an animated rabbit. Hoskins' earlier films include Mona Lisa and The Long Good Friday. I hope you can join us.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you? For that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile. Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides, publishers of Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The strategy's simple. Stay before the public eye by buying the best television time you can afford. But the product's not a political candidate. It's pro wrestling. Coming up, journalist Irvin Muchnick explains how the wrestling establishment makes millions. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward dusts off his copy of The Kinks' Greatest Album. And John Leonard reviews Women in a River Landscape, Heinrich Böll's novel of Germany after the Second World War. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci today ordered the reassignment of at least five Pentagon officials linked to the defense contract procurement scandal. Details from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
The five, including two deputy assistant secretaries, were the targets of FBI raids last week. Their offices were searched in what's being called the biggest Pentagon bribery scandal in American history. All five officials who were reassigned duties today had important responsibilities for overseeing and awarding billions of dollars in military contracts. In a statement, Defense Secretary Carlucci said he's reassigning the five officials whose offices were searched last week, quote, in the interest of ensuring that the ongoing procurements of the department are free from question. As further information becomes available, said Carlucci, the Pentagon will reassess the duties of each of the affected employees. Just where this investigation is leading is still unclear. United Press reported today that among the 4,000 hours of wiretapped conversations, there is one in which then-Secretary of the Navy John Layman tipped off one of his top aides, Melvin Paisley, a major target of the probe, about the ongoing investigation. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
President Reagan today defended his administration against charges that top officials did little to prevent abuse of the procurement system at the Pentagon or investigate charges of fraud once they became known. At a news conference in Toronto, the president said he is disappointed at the scandal involving the purchase of defense secrets by firms seeking government contracts, but he said he believes former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger should be commended for his rebuilding of the Pentagon into the largest defense establishment in U.S. history. He also said he thinks investigators acted properly by not telling him about their probe in its early stages. Senior Israeli government officials today attended the burial of Eli Cohen, an Israeli farmer whose bludgeoned body was found yesterday. Cohen's death has sparked angry reactions as widespread unrest continues in the occupied territories. NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Jerusalem.
The funeral of Eli Cohen attracted Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir and Deputy Prime Minister David Levy today. Shamir used the occasion to declare that Palestinians will not succeed in their goal of, quote, exterminating the Israeli population. Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin said today that Israeli settlers have the responsibility for defense of Jewish settlements. Self-defense, he said, is a part of the security of settlements in the occupied territories. Jewish settlements have asked for more authority to police their own areas, a subject of considerable controversy in the Israeli government. In wide areas of the occupied territories today, there were demonstrations and confrontations with soldiers. Three Arabs were wounded, according to Arab and hospital sources. In one incident, an Israeli civilian driving through the town of Nablus reportedly fired into the air. Arab hospital sources said today that following that incident, a 10-year-old child was admitted to the hospital with a gunshot wound in the leg. There are curfews in eight areas of the territories, and three additional areas are completely closed off. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
The United States will maintain relations with the new military government of Haiti. The State Department today said the U.S. will continue to push for democracy in Haiti using diplomacy, not economic sanctions. Haiti's civilian president, Leslie Monegat, was overthrown yesterday in a military coup led by Army General Henri Nomfi. From exile in Santo Domingo today, Monegat denounced Nomfi as mentally ill and called on the world's democracies to condemn the general's military regime. The streets of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, were quiet today as radio stations delivered news of the coup with announcements from President Nomfi. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average regained the ground lost yesterday. The industrials gained 25 points to close at 2109.17. Advances led declines in trading of 155 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Only one rock group from the British invasion of the 1960s is still together. It's the Kinks. In fact, the group still tours. Their latest album, The Road, was recorded during three U.S. concerts last year. But rock historian Ed Ward says his favorite Kinks songs are from the past.
It's sort of a shorthand. When people my age are getting to know each other, a question that always seems to come up is, did you like the Beatles or the Stones? Well, there was no question as far as I was concerned. The answer was easy. The Kinks.
He don't need no cynics here to ease their trouble mind. At work he is invariably unpleasant and unkind. Why should he care if he is hated in his home? Cause he's got a house in the country and a big sports car.
In the film A Hard Day's Night, the Beatles were asked, are you mods or rockers? And George replied, mockers. That was at least part of the Kinks' appeal. Starting with their 1966 hits, Well-Respected Man and Dedicated Follower of Fashion, they mocked the swinging London scene that Americans looked at from afar with such wonderment. The Kinks not only bit the hand that fed them, they had a little bit of it for tea every afternoon. But there was another thing about the Kinks. In the days before Sgt. Pepper bowled us over with its awesome technology, there existed an album that some of us thought was the finest ever to come out of Britain. Face to Face was released in the fall of 1966, and although it didn't sell all that well, there was no doubt that it had some of the finest songwriting we'd ever heard.
The taxman's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing sunny afternoon, and I can't sail my yacht. He's taken everything I got. All I've got's this sunny afternoon. Save me, save me, save me from this squeeze.
Sunny Afternoon, the story of a man who'd lost everything and just didn't care, was the hit. The last one the band would have for many years, in fact. But as sweet and subtle as it was, there were other pleasures lurking in the grooves of Face to Face. There was the satire of Holiday in Waikiki, for instance, reminding a lot of us that Hawaii was in the USA. The man behind these songs was Raymond Douglas Davies, and we wondered about him. We knew he'd founded the band with his brother Dave, but outside of the songs, he didn't seem to have much visibility. He was never in the chic clubs or dating actresses. The rumors had it that he was depressive, just holding on to his sanity. Songs like Rainy Day in June seemed to bear it out.
Misty shadow spread its wings. Covered all the ground. And even though the sun was out, rain came pouring down. And all the light had disappeared and faded in the gloom. There was no hope, no reasoning.
Early in 1967, the Kinks put out an album called Something Else, a mishmash of tracks including a couple by Dave Davies. But at the end of the record was a song that indicated that maybe Ray had found peace at last. It was, in my opinion, the last truly great song he's written, Waterloo Sunset.
Shine so bright, but I don't need no friends.
Kinks went on to success with a beery, theatrical live show, which never appealed to me. Face-to-Face is out of print now, almost unavailable. But for my money, in 1966, it beat the Beatles and the Stones.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. And happy birthday to Ray Davies. He turns 44 today. This is Fresh Air.
Capacity crowd on hand, certainly enjoying the action thus far here in the World Wrestling Federation.
Wow, look at this guy.
Yes, he is a monster.
The Big Boss Man.
The Big Boss Man from Cobb County, Georgia.
Former prison guard.
Huh, I can see why.
Some people see it as a sport, others see it as pure theater. But no matter what you think of professional wrestling, it's in the midst of a huge revival, fueled partly by clever promotion and partly by the recent growth in cable TV and unaffiliated stations. The revival has made the grunts and groans, the brags and threats of wrestlers standard TV fare. My guest Irvin Muchnick has reported on the growth of professional wrestling and what he calls junk entertainment for such publications as the Washington Monthly, Sports Illustrated, and Mother Jones. He's currently at work on a book about the promotional wars in wrestling. I asked him about the current revival.
Right now, we're in a period, a cultural moment, you might say, where wrestling is thriving. But wrestling is also a huge business. It's probably a $300 million a year business around the world, and probably more than half of that is in the United States. So I think it's a fascinating pop culture phenomenon and a fascinating convergence of marketing forces and other forces in this age of Reagan and Rambo. You know, people can watch it and see all social differences resolved through physical aggression. And it's kind of disturbing also because of its racial and ethnic stereotypes.
I have a feeling that some of our listeners haven't seen wrestling in a long time. So I'm going to ask you to take a stab at describing what wrestling on television looks like now. First of all, I mean, all the wrestlers have to have a persona.
Yeah, you really can't make it now without some kind of handle or gimmick. I mean, every once in a while there's a wrestler whose gimmick is that he has no gimmick and that he just comes in his tights and wrestles. But that's rare. I mean, usually you have to be some ethnic representation, or you have to be a big muscle man, or you have to be some mythic figure, or you have to come in a crazy costume, or you have to come in a mask. And that in combination with your interviews and the way you project your personality through your work in the ring is what makes a professional wrestler as opposed to an amateur wrestler.
Give us some examples of some of the more flamboyant characters in wrestling now.
Well, when you're talking about characters in wrestling, you have to start with Hulk Hogan, of course, who is by far the most successful gate attraction in the history of the sport. He probably makes about $1 million a year and is worth many more times that to his boss at the World Wrestling Federation. Hogan, who's better known to his wife and baby daughter, is Terry Bollea, is a big 6'5", 280, 290-pound, muscle-bound blonde, tanned superhero. And he's become a major figure. He had a cartoon series, a line of dolls, and had a bit role in Rocky III, the movie, and is really wrestling's first all-around mega star celebrity.
I think the question that's most commonly asked about wrestling is it fixed?
No, Virginia, wrestling is not the epitome of the Greco-Roman tradition. The matches are staged. But in a little more complex fashion than most people realize. I mean, not every move is choreographed. Wrestling is an art form. To me, it's an almost a beautifully brutal kind of ballet in which the wrestlers have to play off each other, play off the crowd, have to know some moves and how to get heat, as they say. And the only things that are really planned in advance are the length of the match, the approximate length of the match, and the finishing move.
Let's get to drawing blood. Sometimes the wrestlers bleed in a match. Now, I've read in various places that there have been times when the wrestlers had razor blades on them to draw their own blood so that it would look more dramatic.
Yes, that is in fact the way it's done most commonly. I mean, there may be other ways to do it, but this is the common practice in wrestling. It's called juicing. A wrestler has a razor blade concealed in his trunks or under his wristband or whatever, and at an opportune moment, hopefully when his opponent is distracting the referee and the crowd, he'll nick his forehead, and the blood will gush, and the crowd will go crazy when they see blood. So it's one of those self-mutilating aspects of wrestling that's pretty much accepted within the business, but it's kind of sounds kind of gross to anybody who's not familiar with it.
Is it legal?
It is. It's not illegal in most places. I mean, there are places where they specifically try to crack down on the problem, and it creates a whole new level of problems. In Oregon, they recently tried to ban the practice of blading, and so what happens is that wrestlers start drawing blood legitimately when they feel they have to excite the crowd, and that means that they do it what's called the hard way. They'll take a knuckle and grind it into each other's foreheads, or they'll rub against a ring post or a rope. And, in many ways, that can be more dangerous and unsanitary than using a nice, clean, sterile razor blade. So it gets to the whole problem of wrestling and its appearance versus reality dialectic, because the thing about wrestling is that although people can get injured, that's not actually what they're trying to do to each other. And part of what allows, I think, a lot of fans to suspend their disbelief and enjoy the spectacle of wrestling is the knowledge that that while it's a dangerous and very physical form of entertainment, these guys aren't really getting hurt.
Yet a lot of them do get hurt in spite of the degree to which wrestling is choreographed, because there's still always mistakes that are going to be made.
Mistakes are
bad
made,
falls.
And there are just a lot of things that you can't avoid in this kind of form of show business. It's very dangerous. There are a lot of aerial moves. Moves can be missed, and people can accidentally hit each other with an elbow or whatever.
In the city I live, you can watch wrestling in the morning, I think in the late afternoon, and in the evening. It's on a couple of different stations. There's at least two different wrestling federations that have their own shows in the area. How did wrestling get so much airtime? It certainly didn't have that much airtime when I was growing up.
Well, I think the big factor in the phenomenal growth of wrestling in recent years is changes in the television business. And by that I mean the explosive growth of cable television, for one thing. But beyond that, new stations that have come online in just the last few years, mostly independent stations, and their ravenous need for cheap, easy programming, which wrestling provided in the golden age of television back in the late 40s and 50s, and is doing it again with a vengeance now, because in addition to the new technologies, and home video should be added to that as well, we have an era of galloping deregulation. Promoters, like toy manufacturers with children's cartoon shows, can literally buy their way onto the air.
How does that work? How literally are they buying time? What would the arrangement be?
Literally, the arrangement is, for example, in St. Louis, the World Wrestling Federation pays, I think it is $2,100 a week cash to the station for airing its show. And I think there's probably a percentage deal in there on the sales of tickets at Kiel Auditorium. I know that same kind of arrangement exists out in San Francisco and I think in most of the major markets in the country. And that, in fact, is how the World Wrestling Federation was able to expand from being a regional promotion in the Northeast, which it was a few years ago, to a national and even international merchandising juggernaut, which it is today.
What are your greatest concerns about wrestling now?
I guess my concerns are that there's too much of it, that it's gotten, you know, very gruesome, and it kind of dehumanizes all of us to get, you know, to get too overly wrapped up in this this little fun fringe form of junk entertainment that somehow has become a major league spectacle. But I'm very happy for the guys in the business who work very hard and who are finally, you know, some of them at least, making some big bucks. They deserve it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was my pleasure.
Irvin Muchnick's latest article on wrestling is in the June issue of Washington Monthly. He spoke to us from KQED in San Francisco.
Jamie Boy does it the more conventional, full extension, driving the man into the mat. All right, let's see now what Dynamite can do. He was just tagged in. Ooh, power slam by Davey Boy. Dynamite sending Horowitz to the outside. Dynamite is up in the air. Look out. Oh, my goodness. Forget it. Two and an easy three down. The British Bulldog.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Who's covering the Pentagon procurement scandal for you?
Well, Nina Totenberg is, and also Cokie Roberts is following reaction on Capitol Hill, where one congressman who's been linked to it denies any culpability and then manages a Pentagon spending bill to success on the floor. Do you know what is 40 years old today?
What?
The long-playing record. And we mark that anniversary by visiting a resident of suburban Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C., who brings back to life, cleans up old 78 RPM records. Especially his most famous work is one that he actually recorded of the Duke Ellington Orchestra in 1940.
Great. Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Often the harshest criticism of a government comes from a prominent dissident within. A case in point is the last novel by the Nobel Prize-winning West German author Heinrich Böll. John Leonard has a review of Women in a River Landscape by Heinrich Böll.
The death of Heinrich Böll 3 years ago robbed the West of one of its great liberals. In his novels and stories, and in his service to intellectuals everywhere for 2 decades as an officer of PEN, the International Writers' Organization, he tried to make sense of a divided Germany, an age of totalitarianism, the meaning of terrorism, and the corruptions of the very language we employ to think about all this history gone bloody and wrong. If books like The Clown, Group Portrait with Lady, and The Safety Net seemed less artistically daring and persuasive than similar work by German-language authors like Günter Grass, Peter Handke, and Christa Wolf, they overflowed, nevertheless, with passionate intelligence, stricken conscience, a knowingness about the past and class divisions and the Catholic Church and the modern mind at the end of its tether. He was as morally scrupulous as Thomas Mann and altogether more agreeable as a human being. He worked in his prose toward the saving scruple, the decency that redeems us from squalor and oppression. His was the sort of humanism, as old as Erasmus, that's out of fashion in a century of ideologues and assassins. Women in a River Landscape is an amazing valedictory, a novel entirely in dialogues and soliloquies. The river, of course, is the Rhine. The women, half a dozen of them, are the wives and daughters and lovers of modern-day German bankers, industrialists, judges, and politicians. These women know the truth about a corrupt West German government and the return to power of former Nazis who once ordered the slaughter of their own children, who enriched themselves with the gold from the teeth of the Jews they murdered in the concentration camps, whose avuncular television personalities are a kind of desecration. If the government is corrupt, according to Bowl, so is the justice system, and so are the medical profession and the bedroom. For if these women speak out loud of what they know, they will be sent away to expensive hospitals for the temporarily insane, where they will hang themselves from curtain rods. Even the church is corrupt. The Soviet ambassador might show up at a state funeral or a mass, but Christ certainly isn't there. According to Erica, they've driven him away. He was absent even during the consecration. Not because they're all so sinful, so utterly corrupt, there's nothing new about that. It was because they don't feel themselves to be sinful. They take bribes, they rejoice at the arrival of the rockets, they worship death, and the precious oil that should have been used to anoint his feet, they've put it on the market, dealt in it on the stock exchange. These extraordinary women will win one small victory by the force of their dissent, and they will be abetted in that dissent by a mysterious midnight subversive whose terrorism is entirely symbolic. He sneaks into the houses of bankers and chops up their grand pianos and stacks the piano pieces by the fireplace for a ready burning. No more Beethoven, no more Brahms, no more Mozart. Morally, Germany is tone deaf. Listen to these voices and you will be reminded of the mothers in part two of Goethe's Faust, except that what they speak is a curse. From the grave, Heinrich Böll is telling Germany that he loathes it. Not the least of the sins of that country and this century is that they drove such a brave spirit to such a despairing execration.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's also a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Women in a River Landscape by Heinrich Böll, published by Knopf. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time, I'll talk with reporter Lawrence Weschler. His profiles in the New Yorker magazine capture what he calls the moment when an ordinary person catches fire. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz will review a recent recording of Maurizio Pollini performing three Schubert piano sonatas. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will examine how the drug world has influenced our everyday speech. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Ed Doherty. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Dan Cornwell and Deirdre Benzing. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.